It's Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's past. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark Levonier. In this hour, true history from what seemingly was a very uneventful day, April 1st, 1951, but not on radio. In this hour, we'll hear two programs and an excerpt. Later on, the Comic Weekly Man and Howard K. Smith with the news. But right now, it's Hedda Hopper's Hollywood. A mix of variety, discussion, and gossip, which may or may not have been fact, from April 1st, 1951 on NBC, with special guests Agnes Moorehead, Danny Kaye, and Dor Sherry. From April 1st, 1951 on NBC.
Transcribed.
From Hollywood, NBC brings you Hedda Hopper. With tonight's news brought to life by Agnes Moorehead, Dor Sherry, and Danny Kaye. And here she is, from the desk by the window looking right down on Hollywood and Vine, Hedda Hopper.
Everybody, Nancy Olson, Mrs. Alan Lerner, is expecting a baby. Elise and Tom Harmon expect their third child in August. The Leo Gossies' second child is due in May. Leo was a dead-end kid. Wild Bill Wellman, one of our most prolific directors, tells me his wife is anticipating a seventh child. Yes, it's spring, all right. Ingrid Bergman will soon be in the headlines again. Doris Day won't marry Patty Andrews' ex-husband, Marty Melcher, on April the 3rd, is announced. It's been indefinitely postponed. Reason Doris gives is that she's too busy making a picture. Could be that Rita Hayworth and Ali Khan are separating, but he says no. But then they said no about their marriage, and they said no again about their baby. Margaret Truman's acting appearance with Jimmy Stewart on radio is a prelude to a picture career. If she clicks on the air, she'll entertain offers from Hollywood. Bing Crosby's sunning himself at Palm Springs, and he's not alone. Bill Murrow's with him. I told you, didn't I? Winston Churchill is trying to make up his mind whether he'll pay another visit to America. Orson Welles is on his way back to America with the belief that people have forgiven him for Macbeth. You know, it's quite a coincidence that Pat Neal was stopping at the same hotel as Gary Cooper in Havana, Cuba. I recently visited with Agnes Moorehead, one of the fabulous First Drama Quartet, whose reading performance of George Bernard Shaw's Don Juan in Hell has made theatrical history all across the nation. Well, this type of reading performance is nothing new for Agnes. She told me that her interest in it started when she first heard the late Edna St. Vincent Millay read her own poem, The Harp Weaver. And that's my item for tonight, a chance for Agnes Moorehead to read The Harp Weaver.
Son, said my mother when I was knee-high, you've need of clothes to cover you, and not a rag have I. There's nothing in the house to make a boy breeches, nor shears to cut a cloth with, nor thread to take stitches. There's nothing in the house but a loaf end of rye, and a harp with a woman's head nobody will buy. And she began to cry. That was in the early fall. When came the late fall, son, she said, the sight of you makes your mother's blood crawl. Little skinny shoulder blades sticking through your clothes, and where you'll get a jacket from, God above knows. It's lucky for me, lad, your daddy's in the ground and can't see the way I let his son go around. Oh, and she made a queer sound. That was in the late fall. When the winter came, I'd not a pair of breeches nor a shirt to my name. I couldn't go to school or out of doors to play, and all the other little boys passed our way. Son, said my mother, come climb into my lap, and I'll chafe your little bones while you take a nap. Oh, but we were silly for half an hour or more. Me with my long legs dragging on the floor, a rock, rock, rocking to a Mother Goose rhyme. Oh, but we were happy for half an hour's time. But there was I, a great boy, and what would folks say to hear my mother singing me to sleep all day in such a daft way? Men say the winter was bad that year. Fuel was scarce and food was dear. A wind with a wolf's head howled about our door, and we burned up the chairs and sat upon the floor. All that was left us was a chair we couldn't break, and the harp with a woman's head nobody would take for song or pity's sake. The night before Christmas, I cried with the cold. I cried myself to sleep like a two-year-old. And in the deep night, I felt my mother rise and stare down upon me with love in her eyes. I saw my mother sitting on the one good chair, a light falling on her from I couldn't tell where, looking 19, another day older, and the harp with a woman's head leaned against her shoulder, her thin fingers moving in the thin, tall strings, were weaving wonderful things. Many bright threads from where I couldn't see were running through the harp strings rapidly, and gold threads whistling through my mother's hand. I saw the web grow and the pattern expand. She wove a child's jacket, and when it was done, she laid it on the floor and wove another one. She wove a red cloak so regal to see. She's made it for a king's son, I said, and not for me. But I knew it was for me. She wove a pair of breeches quicker than that. She wove a pair of boots and a little cocked hat. She wove a pair of mittens. She wove a little blouse. She wove all night in the still, cold house. She sang as she worked, and the harp strings spoke. Her voice never faltered, and the thread never broke. And when I awoke, there sat my mother with the harp against her shoulder, looking 19 and not a day older, a smile about her lips and a light about her head, and her hand in the harp string, frozen, dead. And piled up beside her, and toppling to the skies, were the clothes of a king's son. Just my size.
Thank you, Agnes Moorhead. That was so beautiful. Judy Garland was accompanied to New York by Sid Luft, but he didn't go to England with her. Lloyds of London are flying a doctor over to examine Errol Flynn's back. They're trying to save that $2,400 a week they've been paying him since his injury. Perla Mesta will be in San Francisco the end of May to make a speech. I hope she won't choose how to give a party as her subject, because some of the greatest hostesses in the world live in that city. And incidentally, I'm flying to San Francisco on Tuesday to participate in the 58th anniversary of the National Council of Jewish Women. In our town, there's nothing as important as how Hollywood sells itself to the rest of the country, our publicity. The other night, one of our biggest executives, Doris Sherry, vice president in charge of production at MGM, gave a speech to the independent screen publicists. Dory explained his recipe for improving our town's position in the public eye. He said we writers should soft pedal the scandal and the dirt. Do I agree? I certainly do not.
Now, wait a minute, Hedda. If you were to agree with everything I said, and if I were to agree with everything you said, I probably wouldn't be on this program. However, let's agree to disagree agreeably, and let's first decide what we're going to disagree about. I did not ask that writers soft pedal scandal and dirt. I merely ask that we make an effort to loud pedal the accomplishments and achievements of the industry and of most of the people in it.
Well, isn't that distorting the truth? After all, a reporter's job is to report. And if people insist on getting into trouble...
Now,
wait
a minute. If people get into trouble, the Moving Picture Industry Council is all for the reporters reporting the incident exactly as it happened. A personality's conduct is his own responsibility. And I certainly would not pretend to ask the press to suppress anything. We only ask that reporters report some of the plus side and not magnify some of the minus side. For instance, if one of our personalities becomes involved in a hit-and-run case or any other crime, then he has broken the law, and that's legitimate bad news. But if he happens to be at a nightclub and is heckled into an argument, I don't think this is the sort of incident that is big enough news to push Korea off the front page.
Well, that's not the same subject, Dory. You're talking about false reporting.
Well, that's exactly what I talked about to the publicist. There are many stories that are printed only because of the fame of the people concerned. I don't say that this responsibility is the sole responsibility of the press. Very often, antiquated studio publicity notions create false impressions. America is essentially a moral country, and Hollywood a moral city. We're just anxious to have more people know that.
Well, I'll agree with you on that. But why don't you make more pictures showing just that quality? Intruder in the Dust, for instance, may have been a small segment of the truth about America, but it didn't approach the whole truth. America's also essentially human. We love heroes. We adopt movie stars as our own. We're curious to know everything about them, not just half.
Well, that's exactly my point. We know there are plenty of good stories that would be colorful and glamorous enough to satisfy all the readers. We happen to believe that people are as interested in reading good things as they are bad.
Or see the good things on the screen as well as the bad.
Well, we know that it's perfectly human to be interested in stories about people's failings and mistakes. But I was told recently by a very prominent publisher of a national magazine that he devotes 16% of his copy to what we call plus news about Hollywood, and his circulation's increased by 1 million. I think that's a pretty good argument for our point of view.
Since we're talking about truth, Dory, how about picture advertising? For instance, take your picture, Battleground.
Mm-hmm.
Denise Darcel had only a bit in that picture yet. In some of the ads, the public was led to believe that she was more important than she actually was. Why do studios still use that old, stupendous, colossal type of advertising, with every picture advertised as being the greatest and every movie ad with the girl fully undressed? Wouldn't you say that's the same old, false style of public relations?
Well, now, it would be ridiculous for me to say there have not been big errors in motion picture advertising. But this fall is not unique to the picture business. It's true of all businesses. Everybody uses extravagant terms to praise their own product, whether it's indigestion pills, motor cars, floor polish, cigarettes, or movies.
But these were salesmen, Dory, and obviously not seekers after the truth, as we are.
Well, you certainly have a point, truth in advertising. But let me ask you, how many people would buy the toothpaste that was advertised as, this is a nice toothpaste, smells pretty good, won't cure anything, won't get you married or make you a big success, but it isn't much worse than any of the others? Or, this is just another movie. Not the greatest, but it should keep you occupied for an hour and 15 minutes.
Well, how many people are buying our pictures today, Dory?
About 80 million a week.
Well, I had a letter last week from a small theater owner who said, you know, we bought this theater to support us. We ended up supporting the theater. But you still think that the greatest harm done to our industry is when big names are given unpleasant and often unnecessary publicity?
Well, of course. Generally, I have to say that's so.
Well, what about the headlines regarding communists in Hollywood?
Well, they certainly are big headlines. But I'm not too concerned if what finally emerges is the truth. Because the truth will show that there's a tiny small percentage of people who are communists. I'm sure no greater than in any other business or any other section of the country. As a matter of fact, only 100 out of 35,000 are under any cloud.
But ours is a peculiar business. You know and I know that we have the greatest medium for disseminating propaganda, good or bad, in the entire world. It's not just another industry. So what do you think about exposing or defending people like Larry Parks and the others?
Well, I believe that those who refuse to cooperate and refuse to answer the committee can solicit no support from the industry. Those who admit that they once were communist members but who have seen the light of day, well, that's up to the American public. The Daily Mirror in New York in an editorial says, Larry Parks has set a pattern for others in Hollywood. Let him have a square deal.
Okay. Now, I'd like to quote what I said in my column in the New York Daily News. 1, 2, or 10 careers in Hollywood aren't worth a dime unless we're willing to lose them for our country. Why so much emphasis on one career? I, for one, believe that the life of one soldier fighting for our freedom is worth more than all the careers in all of Hollywood.
Well, Larry's a public figure. I was going to say that Larry's a public figure, and certainly the public is going to make that decision. In the case of those individuals who were members of organizations that later became communist-controlled and then got out when they learned that, well, I think they deserve every support.
Yes, if they did get out.
The point is, let's get the truth. And with the truth, I think it is as important that the innocent be protected as it is that the guilty be punished.
Well, Dory, that's why I say we reporters should make public every scrap of evidence we can find. We shouldn't glorify or be soft-hearted about certain quick-change artists who don't sing Yankee Doodle until they're forced to, just one step ahead of the FBI. Right. If, as you say, the actions of a few can blacken our entire industry, then our job is to weed them out just as fast as ever we can.
Well, certainly no one can be against telling the truth about any situation. In connection with that, I should like to say what a man named Maldini said, and I quote, in necessary things, unity. In doubtful things, liberty. In all things, charity.
And in an emergency such as we're in now, action. I still argue that it's urgent that these people be classified, and if they are Reds, then eliminated.
Well, I have an abiding faith in truth, and nothing ever stands in the way of it, ultimately and finally.
If we're talking about the truth, then I say the whole problem of publicity, then, is really up to everyone in Hollywood. It's up to the studios and the stars who must live up to their responsibilities.
Of course.
Because they have been so glorified by the American people.
It's up to everyone, even unglamorous executives. And the writers and columnists who report our town to the world. And that's about where I came in.
And the work has only just begun. We're both for truth and for better public relations. And thank you so much for coming, Dory.
Thank you, Anna.
Josephine Hull was the biggest hit of all the Academy winners, and the youngest glamour girl, Marlena Dietrich. I was so certain that Jose Ferrer and Judy Holliday would win the two top awards that I offered to bet anybody in Hollywood $1,000 on it. I had no takers. But that doesn't mean I thought they were the best. I don't. Celeste Holm and Sam Jaffe were sitting in a New York cafe listening to the awards. When Jaffe lost to George Sanders, he said, well, that's that. Then Celeste lost to Josephine Hull. She turned to Jaffe and said, shall we dance? Richard Basehart flew to London without studio permission to pop the $64 question to Valentina Cortesa. He came back a sadder and a wiser man. You know, I've always been a great admirer of Maurice Chevalier. I'm also a great fan of Danny Kaye. Well, when I saw 20th Century Fox's brand new picture On the Riviera, I really hit the jackpot. Because in this one, Danny out-chevaliers Chevalier. Listen.
If you look, you see the people from Paris playing on the Riviera. Grand as ice and snow, it's nice to Nice to go where the moon, clair de lune, is clearer. All the girls are gay and they parlez français anytime, any place, any way. If you want another kiss but you don't think that you should on the Riviera, oh, you would if you're just out to bust out and see what life can give. The place to live is the Riviera. You know, I tell you, why not come with me on the magic carpet of the motion picture to the playground of the world, Nice, which is just a stone's throw from Cannes, which is just a stone's throw from Monte Carlo, which is just a stone throw from Gibraltar, which is just a stone. As we sail down the Mediterranean, our trip is uneventful, except our cameraman fall overboard. and our director, who have brought along his parents, develop a bad case of mal de mer. He is sick of his mother. We disembark and go immediately to the most famous historic monument of the Riviera, the roulette table. And it is here we find the croupier, man with very bad cough. We express to him our sympathies and he exclaims merci, which means thank you. We reply pas de tout, which means father of twins. Not to be confused with pas de deux, father of idiot twins. Pronounced du, du, du. I'm feeling in any half hardly he gay. Hansi ma, li, is a bar. Hots of all the very hay. Ah, we who, oh, has a. Hot to hold out of her. Hiki hollow all her. And so we leave beautiful Hawaii and come back to the Riviera. Well, the girls are gay, and they parle français anytime, any place, anywhere. If today you have a million and tomorrow you're broke on the Riviera. Oh, big joke if you're just out to bust out and see what life can give. The place to live is the Riviera. Say, you know what I'd like to do, Head? I'd like to come on the show some afternoon and have an argument. You know, I always come on. I'm just a little minstrel boy who's singing songs and things. I'd really like to discuss something with you.
Well, I'd like to discuss anything with you. What should we discuss?
Well,
pick your subject.
All right. You know, being engaged in the motion picture business, I feel that those people, not as a group, but definitely, we have, as we sincerely believe...
Oh, definitely.
That I agree with that. If you were misled by advertising and somebody said, go in and see the picture, it doesn't smell bad, and the toothpaste you use will not be, do you honestly think, well, Hedda, I think we're too childish? Seriously, now, you know that in the last 10 years, pictures have really come of age. As far as musicals, I don't know anything about the other ones, but you remember musical pictures years ago?
I remember them 35 years ago, do you?
Well, goodbye. I remember pictures. When you saw one musical picture, you saw them all, you know. It didn't really matter. You walked in the theater, and if the woman in front did take her hat off and you did look at the screen, what did you see?
Manic Depressive Pictures present...
Wow. Hello, Fresno, goodbye. Produced by R.U. Manic and directed by Depressive. Now you know the name of the picture and you'd like to see it. But no. Screenplay by Gluck, from a stage play by Motz, from a story by Blip, from a chapter by Ronk, from a sentence by Dokes, from a comma by Stokes, from an idea by Gropes, based on Joe Miller's jokes. Now you know the name of the picture and who wrote it. And you'd still like to see it. But no. Art direction, Finkel Puff and Teary, is Minerva Buff Photography, Alonzo Tech Recorded Sound, is Nita Beck Upholstery, by Zachary, Nick Nackery, by Thackery, Tipsickery, by Dickery, and Dickery, by Doc. Now, finally, at last, comes the picture. And what do we see? The same old beautiful chorus girls. The scene is a ranch in Fresno, California. So what are they singing? When it's cherry blossom time in Orange, New Jersey, we'll make a peach of a pear. I know we can elope, so honey, do be mine. And if up from the gulch rides a hunk of man, here's our hero, Cowboy Dan, a galloping, yodeling buckaroo. His horse, of course, is a baritone, too. I've got the old wagon wheels inside of me. I've got that old cactus in the hide of me. I've got that. The girls are delighted to hear this. But where is our heroine?
As the bell rings for lunch, we find our heroine in the corral eating her heart out. She is Mary Swann, tap-dancing daughter of an American juggling act who left her on the doorstep of an old English castle where she was found by Sir Basil Metabolism, who said, by Jove, a girl baby! I shall raise her as my own daughter! Which he did. But she wants to marry Cowboy Dan, who she fell in love with, so she can tap-dance, but she knows Sir Basil, her father, will never permit this. Never, never, never! That's why she's eating her heart out. But through her tears, she is singing a happy little song because she is also a coloratura soprano. Beside herself. Her favorite position.
Oh, Father, you must let me marry Cowboy Dan. He owns the biggest ranch in Texas, bar none.
Bar none? Why, that's the password of the FBI. It can't be.
No, no, yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, no, yes, yes, it can be. But it was. He rushes to Mary Swann. Mary Swann, you must help me out. Can you tap out a messaging code? This is her big chance. Now she can tap dance, which she does. But what has she done? She has betrayed her own father. But he isn't her father. He is Heinrich von Schlupen, mein Gottes Verloben, Haus der Knöbe, der Heldenskneis, aus der Heldenland, aus der Knöbe, der Knöbe, der Herdensen, all am der Knöbe, hol, hol. Junior. Stick up your hands, you dirty rat, and crowd of light, and I can blast a man at the FBI, finally captured the German spy, Dan and Mary, about to blend. You think the picture's about to end? But no. Who ever heard of a musical picture without Carmelita Pepita, the Bolivian bombshell? I wish you would come with me to my little village in Bolivia. So peaceful there are the purple mountains, with the shining stars and the little sky. And the little people who live so simple and quiet. And every night, all they want to do is
grab a partner, swing away, carry about time and hours and days. Grab about teeth and swing about a hair, and you will make a piece of apparel. Grab!
So here we are back in Fresno, California, and this is where you came in. But do not fret, my friends. This is a picture that ends in the middle for the benefit of the people who came in the middle. This is the
thank God we still have our Danny Kays, and we still laugh in America. They don't laugh in Russia.
Next week, NBC will again bring you Hedda Hopper with Hollywood news brought to life by the Andrews sisters, a provocative discussion with Richard Carlson, and a dramatic highlight with Charles Boyer.
Good night, everybody.
Hear Hedda Hopper next Sunday, right after Phil Harris. And in just a moment, hear Theater Guild starring Walter Pidgeon and Signe Hasso in The Fallen Idol. Hedda Hopper's show is produced by FMB, with direction by Gil Faust, music by Frank Worth. This is Art Baker bidding you good night.
This program is transcribed. Three chimes mean good times on NBC. Coming up next, it's The Fallen Idol, starring Walter Pidgeon and Signe Hasso on the Theater Guild on the air. And for adventure in the modern-day Wild West, hear Joel McRae tonight as he stars in Tales of the Texas Rangers, authentic stories of the nation's oldest police force. Now, Hear The Fallen Idol on Theater Guild on NBC.
At a Hopper's Hollywood, on Tuned to Yesterday from April 1st, 1951 on NBC. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVanier, and in this hour, highlighting programs from April 1st of 1951. In addition to NBC broadcasting Hedda Hopper's program on that day, listeners to the network could have also heard crime programs like The Saint with Vincent Price, The Falcon with Les Damon, and Tales of the Texas Rangers with Joel McRae. Over on the Columbia Broadcasting System, there were other crime shows aired, but also lots of comedy. Listeners could have tuned in for the Red Skelton program or Jack Benny's broadcast in the 7 o'clock hour. And there was also a news update from Howard K. Smith, famed CBS radio newsman, one of Murrow's boys, and we'll hear his news roundup next from April 1st, 1951.
Howard K. Smith from London. Each week at this time, Mr. Smith, chief of Columbia's European news staff, reports and analyzes world events. By recording, we take you now to London and Howard K. Smith.
At present, the great argument with Russia is concentrated in two theaters. The struggle for Asia goes on the war front on Korea, and that for Europe at the four-power conference in Paris. In both places, for a short while this week, the prospect of settlement seemed to come almost within reach. But, again in both places, the chance moved back, away beyond grasp, just as hands were reaching out to take it. Regarding Korea, our European friends over here have looked forward with rising hopes to the day when United Nations forces should reach the 38th parallel. There, General MacArthur had predicted, a military stalemate would take place. Reaching that line, General Ridgway had said, would constitute a victory for the United Nations. In other words, our principles and aspirations would then be satisfied. People in Europe hoped that at that point, the Chinese too would realize that they had no chance of reaching and holding any further territory without serious losses. And in that stalemate, or balance, at that symbolic parallel, the long, costly, dangerous Korean episode might at last be brought to an end. Europe's hopes of getting it over with were pointed up by the fact that, according to the almanac, spring began this week, the season for which so many dark predictions of Cold War complications elsewhere in the world have been made, as the Cominform bloc is expected to react to growing Western military power. In Washington this week, Mr. Charles Wilson said, America would soon possess enough military power to deter any aggressor. If he were a principal potential enemy of the United States, Mr. Wilson said, he would be afraid. Well, people over here expect that that is just what the Russians are, afraid and therefore likely to act. And in the spring and summer, before the West does have the predicted adequate strength, people here would feel a lot more comfortable if our best combat strength were not tied up in a nib of territory far away from any other potential theater of action. Moreover, there are other places that could already use the resources that are now tied down in Korea. For example, there is France's chief Asiatic dependency, Indochina, where the strong communist rebel army under Ho Chi Minh is visibly reorganizing and building up for a big spring offensive. This week, the French commander for Indochina, General de Lattre de Tassigny, was in Paris asking his government for more trained French combat forces with which to meet that spring offensive. The French government finally agreed to let him have 13,000 more trained French soldiers. But it was a painful decision for the French government to make, for those trained troops were meant to be the cadres around which four or five French divisions were to be constructed as the core of General Eisenhower's Atlantic Army for the defense of Europe in this coming spring and summer. It will now be very hard for France to fulfill her commitments under the Atlantic Pact at the proper time. And that is one more reason why Europeans had hoped to see an end to the Korean drain by the beginning of spring. As that season opens also, there have come signs that the West may need a strong army in this part of the world. Up until now, it has been hard to visualize how any trouble in Europe could start. there has been no visible pretext for a Cominform initiative of any kind. But this week in the Balkans, a possible pretext appears to be crystallizing. There, in Albania, Russia's smallest satellite, which is cut off from the rest of the Cominform bloc by Yugoslavia, an incident took place about 2 months ago. In the Albanian capital, Tirana, a bomb was exploded in front of the Soviet embassy. By all reports, that incident set off a wave of disaffection among the Albanian people and a reign of terror and a big purge by the communist government of Albania. Across the Adriatic Sea, Albanian conservative exiles now living in Italy decided to fish in the troubled waters of their homeland. They began sending airplanes from Italy over Albania to drop propaganda leaflets. In the past month, it has been reliably reported, 17 such planes have flown over Albania. Last week, then, the Moscow paper Izvestia sounded off in a long editorial against the Western powers. It charged that the Western powers and Yugoslavia were organizing an aggressive war against Albania. And this week, it has been reported, Russian fighter planes have begun to arrive in Albania, transported there by sea through the Dardanelles and around Greece, with the object of shooting down any further airplanes sent from Italy by the exiles. The other day in Yugoslavia itself, Tito's leading newspaper, Borba, issued a front-page protest. It begged Italy to get a grip on the Albanian exiles and stop their airborne sallies over Albania. The paper also said that the Greeks to the south were beginning also to fish in Albanian waters and begged them to stop too. Foreign intervention in that little satellite country, the Tito paper pointed out, would give the Russians what they have not now got, an ideal pretext for attacking Yugoslavia in order to get to and defend Albania against an alleged foreign aggression. Observers in the rest of Western Europe do not make too much of that Albanian situation, but it has served as a reminder that the Balkans is a potential powder keg once more. If Russia's fears of gathering Western power do induce her to take some action, a pretext for launching it is now being created. Thus the profound hope here that the Korean diversion would end by the beginning of spring. To go back to the Korean War itself, people in Europe saw prospects brighten as General Ridgway's troops edged up to the parallel. It was headline news in most newspapers here that representatives of all UN nations fighting in Korea were meeting with the State Department to prepare a big UN policy statement that might bring about talks with China and an end to the war. Then, last weekend, came General MacArthur's latest pronouncement. First reports of his statement reaching here said merely that he had offered to meet the Chinese field commander to arrange an end to hostilities. That was all right. But then, last Sunday morning, fuller reports of his statement came through, and they revealed that General MacArthur had made two further points which made it virtually certain the Chinese would not accept his offer. First, he had said that any such talks as he proposed would cover only Korean hostilities and not other related Far Eastern topics such as Formosa. Well, the Chinese have said, and most UN members have said, there can be no solution without discussing those other linked topics at the same time. Second, MacArthur added to his offer the veiled threat of an attack on the Chinese mainland, and he said if it came, Red China would be faced with imminent military collapse. In other words, he made it almost a condition to the talks that the Chinese come to him as virtually defeated supplicants, which of course they will not do, since they still hold nearly two-thirds of the area of Korea. Well, General MacArthur has had a consistently bad press in Europe since the Korean War began. But on this occasion, the papers here really hit the roof. For the first time, many of them made outright demands for his retirement. It is high time, the London News Chronicle said, that someone had the pluck to tell this aging general he should quit. The Daily Mirror said, so long as MacArthur remains on the scene, the world will remain on edge. Observers would be relieved if he should go home. Even the intensely pro-American Economist of London called the new MacArthur statement one of the most mischievous of all his pronouncements. And the London Times hinted that MacArthur had deliberately acted to beat the peacemaking UN policy statement to the public in order to prevent an end to the war. Now, the Chinese have, as expected, spurned his offer. They might have refused peace talks anyhow, but the world will now never know. Reports from Washington say that the UN delegates have had to hold back their policy statement and change it in view of the changed situation. Here in Europe, people generally expect that we shall have to await one more wave of fighting and bloodshed, possibly a big spring offensive by the communists, before another good chance of creating balance and opening talks occurs. Meanwhile, spring begins with our best combat forces tied down in Korea, halfway around the world from the most important potential centers of conflict. The Paris Conference of Foreign Ministers' Deputies is a far less exciting and less significant theater of the Cold War. Its purpose is, to quote a French commentator this week, merely to try to agree to an agenda of topics which the foreign ministers will agree to try to agree to at a four-power meeting later on this year in Washington. But it is a reflection of how taut, how totally without slack, European issues in the Cold War have become, that after four long weeks of talks, the deputies in Paris are still not agreed on what their bosses may talk about. The main issue dividing them for most of this time has been the issue of Germany. Russia has wanted the demilitarization of Germany to be item number one on the agenda and to be discussed in isolation from all other topics. The Western delegates have insisted Germany must be discussed only in connection with other causes of world tension in Europe. For example, the high level of Cominform armament. What seems to be afoot is this. The Russians seek to commit the West to an agreement not to rearm Germany. They want to keep Germany, while its powerful Ruhr district is in Western hands, as a military vacuum. The Western delegates believe, on the other hand, that if Germany were left a vacuum, it would be dominated by the strongest armed power on the continent, and that, of course, is Russia and the Cominform bloc. So the Western delegates have insisted that the topic of German militarization can be discussed only in direct connection with the high level of arms in the Soviet bloc. Well, this week, Mr. Gromyko of Russia finally gave way on this question and agreed to include Germany in an item with other causes of tension in Europe. He gave way to the Western view on several other thorny but secondary points also. It looked as though at last agreement in Paris was in sight. The Western delegates at the agenda talks were pleasantly surprised at Gromyko's concessions, and they asked that they might be granted a full day without talks in order to consider the concessions. But when they returned to the conference table after their day off, Mr. Gromyko's amiable attitude had suddenly changed. He refused to clarify several points in his proposals that he had left vague. He refused to accede to a request that future talks be held in secret so that agreement might be reached. And to keep the pot boiling, he threw in two brand new, highly contentious items proposed by the Soviet Union for the agenda. This weekend, final agreement seems as far away as ever. This is especially regretted here in Europe, for an early agreed agenda would mean an early conference of the big four foreign ministers. And if nothing else came from such a conference, at least it would keep the Soviets spotlighted, talking of peace, and therefore in a bad psychological position to undertake any aggressive adventures. This hope, however, like that of ending the Korean War by spring, has had to be postponed. and Europe enters upon springtime with not much better defense than millions of pairs of crossed fingers. This is Howard K. Smith in London. I return you now to CBS in New York.
You have been listening to the chief of Columbia's European news staff in a recorded broadcast from London. Howard K. Smith is heard each week at this time. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Howard K. Smith and the news on CBS from April 1st, 1951. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday with your host, Mark Livigno, highlighting programs from April 1st of 1951. And to wrap up this hour, an excerpt of one of the more interesting broadcasts from radio's past, and that is the Comic Weekly Man. On air in syndication from 1947 through 1954, this show was an effort to get readers of the Hearst newspaper, particularly the kids, to follow along on radio with a comic strip that was printed in the paper. Although many comic adventures were dramatized on radio, like the adventures of Jungle Jim, usually the stories were spread out and expanded upon because the three or four panels wouldn't necessarily fill up a half hour. With some exceptions, like New York City Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia famously reading the Little Orphan Annie comic on the radio during his weekly address while there was a newspaper strike in the city. Next, an excerpt to give you the flavor of the Comic Weekly Man program from April 1st, 1951.
I'm the Comic Weekly Man, the jolly Comic Weekly Man, and I'm here to read the funnies to you happy boys and honeys. Yes, boys and girls, it's Comic Weekly time, and here I come right into your house to bring a little fun and happiness, right out of the pages of Puck the Comic Weekly, straight into your living room, your friend the Comic Weekly Man, the jolly Comic Weekly Man. Hello, hello, hello. Hello, hello, hello. No one here to listen to me today? All right. Guess I'll just have to run along. Goodbye, no one.
April Fool, I'm here.
April Fool, I just left.
Well, come back again, please, and read me the funnies.
April Fool, I will.
I knew you were just playing with me.
Oh, yes, April Fool's a good game, isn't it?
Yes, I had lots of fun. I fooled lots of people.
Well, good for you. Now let's fool around with the funnies.
All right, please.
All right, I'll read Puck the Comic Weekly in just a moment. But first, let's listen to this nice man. Now, here we go with Puck the Comic Weekly. And on the first page...
Hop along, Cassidy.
And that we'll read right now.
Magic words for the music, please.
Very well, my lady. Six guns blazing as he thunders along. Give us music for Hop Along. Hoppy, California, and Lucky have been put in jail by the sheriff of Rio Vista on a charge of kidnapping Don Ramon's boy, Felipe. No one will believe Hoppy's story, that he saved Felipe from outlaws. In the meantime, Sloat and his gang have stirred up the citizens of Rio Vista, and they've all marched on the jail in an endeavor to break it open and hang Hoppy and his pals without a trial. The sheriff steps out in front of the jail, faces the huge mob of men, and asks the ringleader,
"What's wanted, gents?"
The spokesman for the lynching crowd replies,
"Cassidy and his two sidekicks. We don't like mavericks or their cut. Wasting the taxpayers' money and long trials. We're taking the prisoners off your hands, Sheriff."
The sheriff replies,
"Whoever put you up to this has been reading the wrong law books. Mine doesn't favor lynching. Now scatter."
One of the men in the crowd yells,
"You heard his answer. What are we going to do about it?
Either the sheriff unlocks the door or we batter it in."
But the sheriff doesn't give in. He lives up to his duty to defend the men in his jail until they're proven guilty, a thing any honest sheriff will do. Some of the men in the crowd take a huge log and begin to batter against the door. The sheriff slips inside the jail. He tells Hoppy and his pals in the third picture in the third row,
"I'm turning you loose for your own protection. Quick, out the back door."
First picture next row, Hoppy, Lucky, and California open the back door and start to slip out. When... a shot nicks the wall right above California's ear. He shouts,
"Get back! We got us surrounded!"
Hoppy steps back in, takes a quick look around, and sees the door is beginning to crack. He sees a trap door in the roof. Hoppy exclaims,
"The roof! It's our only chance!"
He leaps on the desk and draws himself up through the trap door. The sheriff says,
"Your horses are in the side alley, if you can make it."
Hoppy pulls himself up through the trap door, gives Lucky and California a hand. And first picture, next row, they quietly slip over to the edge of the roof, then let themselves down to the ground. And first picture, bottom row, they're on their horses, galloping off, unnoticed by the mob. As they reach the edge of the town, Hoppy says, "Well, whoever stirred up that lynch movement is afraid of us." Lucky replies, "Yeah, I wonder what they'll try next, Hoppy." Last picture, they approach a sign which reads, "Don Ramos Madeira property to be sold this Wednesday at public auction by order of Prentice Vane, tax assessor, Rio Vista."
My, wasn't it nice of that sheriff to help Hoppy and his friends escape?
It certainly was, because lynching is against the law. You know, one of the wonderful things about this country is that every man has the right to a fair trial. And these people were not going to give Hoppy a fair trial. They were going to hang him.
And if they had, they would have hanged an innocent man. And anyone who'd do that, well, they're just as bad as the criminal themselves.
I'm glad you feel that way.
Yes, so am I, because it is wrong. It's just as bad as being bad.
Mm-hmm. And next week we'll find out whether Hoppy will find a way to save Don Ramos from having to sell his ranch.
Oh, I hope he does.
So do I.
An excerpt of the Comic Weekly Man on Tuned to Yesterday from April 1st, 1951, from Hearst Syndication. And that closes this hour of True History, focusing in on April 1st, 1951, on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.